Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, and welcome to the subscriber version of Inside Total Film. And thanks for taking out a subscription. We are so pleased that you did. And today I'm joined by our editor at large, Jamie Graham.
Hello.
And our contributor, Leila Latif.
Hi.
Hello, you two. So this week we're going to be talking about The Hitman's Wife's Bodyguard, In the Heights, In the Earth, Luca, and Monster Hunter. But before we start on those, what have you guys been watching this week?
I'm not normally a reality television person, but I really love Julia Roberts and the film Erin Brockovich. So I've been watching The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills because it has inadvertently become a sequel to Erin Brockovich, where the real life lawyer from Erin Brockovich is married to one of the real housewives. And it turns out that they've been embezzling funds from all of the Erin Brockovich style lawsuits to pay for their expensive lifestyle. So it's, you know, it's an unexpected sequel and I'm really enjoying it.
Brilliant. I've been watching, obviously, the films for this podcast. There's a few of them we've got to get through. Obviously, the European Championships, being a football fan, because it's kicked off, so I'm watching as many games as I can, but I won't bore you with that. The other thing I've been watching is a lot of Bo Burnham, because I watched Inside, his new kind of comedy special filmed in lockdown that came out a couple of weeks ago. Absolutely adored it. So then I went back and watched Make Happy and What, which are his two other comedy specials on Netflix, which were both done on stages. And absolutely love both of those as well. Rewatched Eighth Grade, which I'd seen a couple of times before. So I've just been on a real Bo Burnham binge and I can't get enough of him.
I have to say I watched Inside as well and was texting Jamie throughout going, I don't get it. I don't like it. I don't get it. Oh, I kind of like it. Oh, I really like it. Oh, I really get it. And so that was the journey I went on with that one.
Yeah.
But I did try his other specials and I didn't like them as much. No, so I think I really like the whole, you know, going slightly mad indoors scenario that he's got going on with his Inside special. And one of the songs, which was White Woman's Instagram, I couldn't stop singing. It was a total earworm. So well worth checking out.
He's got an amazing episode of Parks and Recreation where he's a young Christian, like youth singer, sort of like a bit of a kind of very Christian Justin Bieber, where he's absolutely brilliant.
Okay. Well, he is brilliant, isn't he? And he's so good in Promising Young Woman. I mean,
the best.
Yeah.
He's so clever and he's about 12. So it's very frustrating.
Just turned 30, which he turns during Inside, because he's filmed it over a year in lockdown, and at one point he turns 30, and it's kind of sickening because his first comedy special he did on Netflix, he was something like 22, and he's just sat there with all these genius rhymes and sort of commentary on state of the nation and kind of all, you know, media today and different age gaps and technology and everything. He's got such a sharp take on everything.
I remember him when he was just like a YouTube star and he just had this really catchy song called Oh Bo. It's gotten a lot more profound since then.
A bit more political than that, but he is a talented chap. Shall we move on and have a look and see if there's some other talented folk in our selection this week? It's time to strap on the Kevlar for this.
Michael Bryce was trying to put his past behind him.
You need to forget bodyguarding. Repeat after me. No bodyguarding.
No
bodyguarding.
Then he got pulled back in.
Let's go!
Jesus!
To protect this homicidal nutbag's wife.
What is he doing here? I said,
get anyone but Michael Bryce.
I believe it's pronounced, thank you.
So that is The Hitman's Wife's Bodyguard, the sequel to The Hitman's Bodyguard. Jamie, tell us, where is the hitman and where is the wife? What's going on with this one?
Well, the hitman, Michael Bryce, played by Ryan Reynolds, he is now on sabbatical because after the events of the first movie, he's so kind of shell-shocked by it all that his therapist tells him, give up being a bodyguard for a while, get away from the carnage. And he takes that advice and he goes off and he's on his sun lounger and he's having a lovely break. And suddenly bursting rudely into his world is Selma Hayek's character, Sonya Kincaid, who was a kind of supporting role in the first movie. And she bursts in and she says, we need you. You've got to help me. You've got to come and help me rescue my husband, Darius Kincaid, played by Samuel Jackson, again in the first movie. We've got to go and get him, sir, against his better judgment, because also he hates Darius. They just did not get on at all. In the first film, he has to go and kind of help him out and rescue him. And he gets embroiled in a big plot that involves Antonio Banderas as a Greek shipping magnate who wants to bring down the European Union in revenge for these kind of sanctions that have been passed against Greece. And we go on another journey like we did in the first one. There's lots of sort of lovely geography they go across, burning most of it as they go, exploding most of it. And like the first one, it's a lot of foul mouth kind of banter. It's Ryan Reynolds doing his usual kind of snarky motor mouth routine. Sonia Kincaid, played by Salma Hayek, has been brought very much front and centre in this one. Because in the first one, she just pops up in a few scenes and people really liked her. The people who did like Hitman's Bodyguard, which wasn't too many people, but the ones who did, they kind of felt she was the best thing in it. So they've obviously taken that and said, right, we're going to run with that and put her as a central character. So she's really foul-mouthed and she's always screeching and pulling guns and she gets in on the action and she's just an absolute kind of whirlwind in this film. Now, this is the thing. I imagine most people, and the early buzz seems to be on Twitter, most people will absolutely hate it. And I can totally see why, because it is very, very violent. It's foul mouth. It never stops. It's sort of just knowingly bad in a way, but it embraces its badness because it's just really ridiculously over the top movie. And I can see why people would hate it. Because again, also the violence in this film, there's so much violence and it's a kind of violence where there's no human cost. It just kills people and doesn't care about them. There's no like...
I mean, this is a body count like Rambo, isn't it?
It really is. And they're just there to be mowed down. That's it. There's no like, you know, repercussions or like thinking of the families or grief or anything like that. So I can see why people hate it. For some reason, and maybe it was just the mood I was in, I really enjoyed it. And I hated the first one. And this is more of the same of the first one. So I'm not quite sure why I enjoyed it.
Had you had a drink?
I did.
Were you pleasantly imbibed? What was going
it's
on?
It's mad. I think maybe my expectations were so low that I went into it thinking I'm going to hate this. And I just went with it. I enjoyed Ryan Reynolds. I found his sort of snarkiness really funny. And normally he doesn't massively do it for me. And I think the reason I quite enjoyed it is just the fact that it, like I said a minute ago, it's so knowingly bad. Like it's so over the top. There's one bit where Ryan Reynolds is describing how his mother got killed. And it's a ridiculous scene.
So ridiculous.
It's so ridiculous how she got killed. And then Salma Hayek turns around to kind of say, oh, you know, poor baby, I'll look after you. And then she says, well, my mother or my father, I can't remember what it was, got eaten by a shark. And it's that kind of movie where, you know,
literally jumps the shark.
Yeah, it hasn't got a serious bone in its body. And because I was in the mood for that, I kind of enjoyed it. But I'll hand it over to you two, who I imagine will now rip it to pieces.
Layla, did you enjoy it?
You know what? I was sitting in the cinema watching it and I was hearing laughs from the people. And to be fair, at that screening, they had given us all alcohol. And I was thinking that, like, no, this isn't good, but maybe this is so bad that it's good. And I actually think it's actually not quite bad enough to be so bad that it's good either. So it kind of failed for me twice, but I really enjoyed Selma Hayek in it. Like, I felt that Samuel L. Jackson and Ryan Reynolds, they were just doing their same old shtick, which we've seen a million times before. And it just, the whole thing felt like nobody, like, gave a damn. And then Selma Hayek was just that little bit more unhinged. So actually, when she was on screen talking about, you know, the size of her genitals, I was actually like, this is kind of so nuts that it's gone into the so bad that it's good vibe for me.
But you feel like she was performing in a different movie from the rest of them?
I think she was
memo.
I think she was performing. She was trying something. I think the other two were just like, they were almost like they'd just seen like six GIFs of themselves and been like, yeah, okay, I'll just do those things that I'm kind of known for. And yeah, and like then the whole thing of it being set in this kind of like Italian Tuscan beautiful countryside just remind me of that weird period where Adam Sandler seemed to only make films in places he wanted to go on holiday to.
Yeah.
So like the whole thing just felt like nobody was trying hard enough aside from Salma Hayek, who
It's like they had a little WhatsApp group and they're like, where does anyone fancy doing our next movie? And somebody went, I hear Tuscany is lovely this time of year. Shall we just do it there? And you know, they do go to some beautiful places, don't they? But
yeah.
It's nonsense.
And also, it's the first one was a surprising hit. I don't think they quite expected it, and it did really well. So this one, like you said, number one, there's the beautiful locations, and they're obviously all enjoying themselves. But it's also got a noticeably bigger budget. That, you know, I reckon this must be 70, 80 million, and there's so much carnage and explosions. And so it's like the first one amped up even more, if you can imagine that, because yeah. The first one pretty in your face as well.
I found myself thinking that this film, I would only enjoy it on an aeroplane. It was exactly that sort of mid-tier, not particularly good fare that you could watch on a plane, go to the loo, stand in a queue, do your business, come back, not have missed an entire section and actually have missed nothing. An altitude might make it a bit funnier and a few little bevvies might make it a bit funnier. But on the ground, I actually found it borderline offensive.
I don't love that kind of, it doesn't seem to matter what age a woman in these films is, that they have to bring in that she desperately wants to be a mother as a plot point. I was like, really, do we have to do this? Samuel L. Jackson is in his 70s. Salma Hayek is, I assume, in her 50s. I mean, looking, you know, fresh as a daisy, but still. And it was just like, there's a part of me groaned when they introduced that storyline.
Yeah, and I also I just found it really sad that she had to grasp her own boobs and wave them in Ryan Reynolds' face saying, you love my boobs. Oh, Salma, have you not learnt from getting your ass out in Wild Wild West? I mean, we don't need to do this. You've directed a film about, you know, Frida Kahlo. Why are you doing this? I don't think you need
it's,
to.
It's also got a running gag that the Kincaids are kind of using this trip as their honeymoon as well, because they got interrupted last time. So every single opportunity they can throughout this sort of violent road trip, they're having sex. And there's Ryan Reynolds sort of sat in the back of a car listening to them going for it and just going like, oh, my God, not again. And it's this kind of running joke, which, again, that's the tone of the film. It's very juvenile, puerile, sort of teenage boy kind of stuff.
The part I did enjoy was Antonio Banderas's wardrobe. He wears a sort of fabulous Euro trash sort of what Philip Green might wear on his yacht scenario, and that it reunited him and Salma Hayek. So
isn't that a bit sad? There's kind of so much build up about like, when are we going to get these two reunited? It's going to be amazing. And then they are and kind of nothing happens.
Yeah.
They don't give them anything fun to do.
I enjoyed the fact that Antonio Banderas is playing a Greek sort of magnate, and he makes no attempt whatsoever to do any kind of accent.
No.
Which again is the kind of film it is. It just almost knows it's bad and he just turns up, takes the money, does his usual.
But also, this isn't a film that requires you to do anything that is realistic. So like, just do your Spanish accent, Antonio, because all accents are the same in this world. Like, it's a Euro accent. That will do.
Talking of not being realistic, Ryan Reynolds gets hit by a car about 4 times in this film. And every time he sort of chucked 12 feet in the air and he's collapsed on the ground, not breathing for a couple of minutes. And he gets up and off he goes, you know,
right,
hasn't even
rain.
Got a broken ankle. It's just mad. It's really cartoonish. That's what it is.
It is. It's very sort of Tom and Jerry, isn't it? Is it going to be fun for a Friday night? It's out this Friday. Is it something to go along to the pictures with your friends and have a good time, do we think?
I would say yes, if you know what you're getting and you're in a riotous mood and leave your brain at the door, that kind of movie. I think if you want a bit more than that, then no, it could really just slap you between the eyes to the point that you're passing out of boredom, pummel you.
I don't think Layla would be taking her friends.
No, I think maybe on an aeroplane or sort of on Channel 5 on a Sunday when you're a bit hungover, that's that sort of vibe where you really don't want to engage too much. But yeah, there's better stuff out at the moment. I wouldn't bother.
There is. So shall we have a look and see what else is out this week that might tickle you a little bit more? It's time to get your dancing shoes on with this.
What does sueñito mean?
Sueñito. It means little dream.
That's it? No story?
All right. Everybody sit down. Yeah!
It's a story of a block that was disappearing.
So that's In the Heights. For those that don't know what this musical is about, Layla, give us a little log line of In the Heights.
So this is based on a musical written by Lin-Manuel Miranda. It was the musical he won the Tony for before Hamilton, who wrote it whilst he was at NYU. It is set in Washington Heights, which is like the very, very north bit of Manhattan, kind of above Harlem, where there's a big Puerto Rican community. And it's kind of takes place over a few days before and after a blackout that happens. And it's kind of just a big ensemble cast of characters and the various conflicts that they go through in that time living in the Heights.
In the Heights. And it has that very particular style that Hamilton had of the sort of rap singing that isn't everybody's cup of tea, but is very particular to Lin-Manuel Miranda. Did you enjoy it?
I did. I'm a huge Lin-Manuel Miranda fan. I've seen Hamilton 4 times on the stage. I've seen it in the Heights twice. And it was really cool because he's got this style on the stage of like really Brechtian, not really much of a set. People don't change their costumes. Yeah. And so actually seeing it realized to the screen is like a huge transition, and like going from just really hearing songs and having to imagine it to seeing it fully realized. I was nervous with John M. Chu because I know I'm in the minority normally, but I really didn't like Crazy Lyric Asians. I thought it was all style and no substance. I thought these things really merged beautifully because Lin-Manuel Miranda's got a huge amount of substance. And then John M. Chu had kind of the vision to like pull it off. So when you've got like, there's an amazing set piece halfway through where they're at the community pool singing.
Oh, yeah.
And it's incredible choreography and it's done beautifully. But then if you actually listen to what they're singing about, where they're talking about, oh, what I would do with $96,000. It's all about like, you know, ingrained poverty in our area and like the debts that I have to pay off and the monies that I can pay to my lawyers or I can send to support my family. So it's like everything had this like real richness to it that I thought like these two kind of visionaries worked really well together.
I have never seen In the Heights. Have you, Jamie?
I haven't seen In the Heights on the stage, no. But to pick up on something that Layla just said, I did love the fact that it was obviously filmed in Washington Heights on the streets. You can really feel the heat. It's a bit like Do the Right Thing, that you get a sense of over a few days with a boiling sun, all this action happening in one neighborhood. And you've got the George Washington Bridge, like, you know, backdropped between the streets. You can always see it in the distance. And it felt really vibrant to me, you know, on top of all the songs and the amazing wordplay, the lyrics and everything. It's got a real pep to it. I really enjoyed it.
I loved it. I thought it was a perfect summer movie. I mean, we're currently sweltering here having this chat with our fans on, and that feels like the perfect time for the film to come out and to watch it and see people, you know, eating ice creams and splashing about in the pool and hot summer nights and the sort of exoticism as well of the bookends of Dominican Republic in there. I just felt transported by it, actually, which is quite hard to do these days for me. I find myself very difficult to be transported by a film and truly taken somewhere else, and it really, really did. But there is some controversy around it, isn't there, Layla?
Yeah, there is a little that's come out at the moment where they've been accused of sort of having some like colorism in the casting of this, that they've kind of gone with you know, paler members of the Latinx community and not included a lot of Afro-Latino people. And then, you know, Rita Moreno came out to its defense and stuff. And Lin-Manuel Miranda has and John M. Chu have apologized, saying that like this was not something that they were aware of. And if they'd kind of, in retrospect, they would have done things differently. Sure, it's great something that comes forward, but I do think it does seem a shame that when you do have films made by minorities, there is this responsibility that you have to represent everyone, whilst, you know, somebody gets to make Moulin Rouge or Chicago or one of those wonderful musicals, and it's just like, oh, you can just kind of make a film, like you don't have to make a responsibility. So yeah, I mean, I hope they take it on board. We'll see some less colorism in kind of future films, but I don't think that's a reason to write off this film, because I just think it's wonderful. And like watching it, I felt physical waves of joy hitting me.
Yeah, I mean, I finished it and wanted to start it again from the beginning and regretted having seen it on a laptop because I didn't see it on a big screen. But I would definitely, I think, go and see it again on a big screen with an ice cream in hand. What about Anthony Ramos? I mean, he's obviously taking on the role that Lin-Manuel Miranda originated off-Broadway. And he was in the Heights playing the boy originally, but he's now sort of grown to the man. Isn't this like a superstar in the making? We've seen him in A Star Is Born. We saw him as Gaga's friend in that. And we've seen him in Hamilton, you know, when they did that for Disney. And he's really good in other things, in sort of indie films. But I felt like this was a moment where people will say, that's when I knew who Anthony Ramos was.
And you just get that from the trailer. You don't even need to see the film. You watch the trailer and he sort of breaks the fourth wall and he talks to the audience and he's got this glimmer in his eye and he's got this smile that is just absolutely radiant and heart-melting and cheeky and fun. And he's just an absolute star in the making. You know, all the young cast in this are great. I think they're all like kind of people you fall in love with, that you enjoy spending time with and just want to watch a movie again to hang out with them some more. But of a very good cast, he is for me the standout. But it's like, you know, you get those moments, those star-making turns, like a young Tom Cruise in Risky Business or something, someone who just has that, you know, star quality and burns off the screen. And for me, he has it. Yeah, definitely.
Same.
Yeah, he just radiates something, doesn't he? But I mean, but so many of the smaller people are also wonderful as well. I love Stephanie Beatrice, who I love Brooklyn Nine-Nine. So I was a fan of hers, yes, doing something completely different. Her and Dasha Polanco is hyper feminine women that work in the salon. And also Olga Meredes as the abuela. Her song was a real highlight for me.
I cried.
And I believe she was in the stage show. Yeah. And there's a line that I just felt like kind of, I was in floods of tears, where she talks about her mother's gloves that would make her look beautiful and hand embroidered napkins. Because if you're a victim of racism, when you have something beautiful, it humanizes you. And I was just like, whoa, my God.
Yes.
Like, not expecting this from like a John M. Chu musical, like Stab Through the Heart.
There was some deep themes going on here that, you know, you could certainly walk out of this and just say that was a toe tapper, but equally you could also have a really good conversation about what it was talking about.
And also, just to go back quickly to the kind of controversy over the colorism, one thing I would say very, very, very much in this film's favor is, because it's been written by Lin-Manuel Miranda, you really do get a sense, the community spirit in this film, that you're watching everyone and they're all pulling for each other. It really feels vibrant and authentic. And I think that if a white person had written this or had come in to direct this, they would probably try to make it more gritty and said, oh, a bit of crime, bit of gunplay and all those usual stereotypical nonsense. And if you actually look into it, like Washington Heights is one of the lowest crime rates in any part of New York and all that. And it is just a really friendly, vibrant community. And that's what I loved about this film, that you sit down and watch it and it's just 2 hours of enjoyment and everyone kind of having fun and dreaming big, the American dream. And, you know, that there is downsides as well, but we're all not going to achieve the American dream. But it just has that sense of optimism and joy and going about your business with your neighbors.
Yeah, but it also does question, what is the American dream, and is there such a thing, and is it different for different communities, and how do you succeed at that, and what is success and what does it look like? I really loved the sort of the theme that was going on with the girl who was, you know, torn about going to college. And it was like, you have to go to college because you're the first in the family to go to college. Why would you not go to college? And the immense, you know, pressure, weight on her shoulders and the pressure on her shoulders from her community that she felt. And what is success? Is it going to college and doing that thing? Or is it actually doing the thing you want to do and making a great success of that and being happy? And those sort of things. I just thought there was so much going on in it. And you do get Lin-Manuel Miranda pushing his little cart through it in the middle, which is nice as well. So yeah, all round an absolute corker.
Also, that there is like that rare thing of like the immigrant to America who wants to leave. Like, we don't see that often, but like Anthony Ramos's character wants to go back to the Dominican Republic.
You're right. We don't see that story, that wanting to go back to the homeland and the lure of that and the draw of that and that being the dream. Going the other way is the thing that's often depicted.
Me being half Sydney's, I've got to tell you, when I talk to my Sydney's friends, that's kind of all we talk about. Like, really? When are you going to go back? Do you think it's time now? Like, So it was nice to kind of see that.
Yeah. So we could expect you to be telling little children all about wanting to go back and singing a little rap song, we, Layla?
Yeah, from some kind of pyramid structure that I've created. Ancient Nubian vibes.
Yes. Okay, cool. So we are highly recommending this, aren't we?
Definitely. We are. I'm like you, Jane. I saw it on my TV and I will be going to see it in the cinema this week. You know, when it comes out, I want to see it with a crowd and have all that joy, the community feel in the cinema.
Indeed. Okay, so that is In the Heights and it's out in cinemas this Friday. Let's go for something completely different then, that's also out this Friday. Shall we get back to nature with this?
So what are you working on?
Searching ways of making crops more efficient.
Funny place to study crops in a forest.
We had to send a rescue party in to get a group out a couple of months ago. They got lost.
Why didn't they use GPRS?
There's no phone reception in there. People get a bit funny in the woods sometimes.
So this is In the Earth, Ben Wheatley's latest, that was created during lockdown. Jamie, what's this about?
So it's about Dr. Martin Lowery, played by Joel Fry. It's set after a virus has been a devastating virus. So you've obviously got the COVID-19 kind of parallels there. But that is very much a jumping off point for this film. It's not like a Contagion, you know, by Soderbergh, where it's following that virus. We're set in the aftermath. He's living in isolation, doing some research, and he needs to trek to a research hub deep in the forest. So he sets out on foot with Alma, played by Allura Tortia, and they are basically trekking through the forest to get to the research hub to go and see Olivia Wendell, who is a doctor played by Hayley Squires. And, you know, they think that she may have the key to kind of unlocking what is going on and, you know, save people, really. And a bit like, you know, having the vaccine to a pandemic almost. It's like, yeah, you know, will she hold the key to this mystery? And anyway, en route to this research hub, they get attacked, mysteriously attacked. They're left in a state of kind of befuddlement with no shoes. And they bump into a guy called Zach, played by Reese Shearsmith, who initially sort of comes along to help them. And then things turn a little bit darker from there. I don't want to give too much away.
Say no more. It's certainly a sort of hallucinogenic, lysergic film from Wheatley. And he has said it's sort of Marmite. He's pushed it. He did it to a certain degree. And then he pushed it even further, almost to bait audiences.
Yeah.
How did you feel about it, Layla?
I liked it, not loved it, which I suppose doesn't work with his Marmite analogy. It's really weird. It's very oversaturated with ideas, but in a way that I quite enjoyed. Like, you've got some necromancy, you've got some magical fungus, you've got a pandemic, there's a bit of a love triangle.
Yeah.
With some hallucinations, paganism. I think there's a bit about missing child cases. Like, you know, it's a lot that was thrown on screen. It does feel that, like, maybe he was in a rush to make a bit of a pandemic project. But, you know, it's kind of Ben Wheatley going back to his roots. It's got a lot of the feelings of Kill List and A Field in England back in there. Reese Shearsmith is wonderful in it. I think he's just really, really suits Wheatley's sensibilities. I did kind of feel at the end of it, though, that maybe a bit like I did with The Rise of Skywalker, like, this is just them giving us what we want a little bit. Like, you know, after Rebecca, he was just like, okay, I've heard your criticism, I'm going to go back and give you guys what you want. You want me to do kind of weird, wonderful horror films. And there's something a little dissatisfying about just kind of being given what you want in a weird way. So though it was nice for him to kind of do something similar to his first films that I really, really loved, in a way, what I'd like Ben Wheatley to do is kind of surprise me.
I bet he didn't expect it to be compared to Star Wars films. No. Certainly probably not what he expected. Jamie, what are you're a Wheatley fan, aren't you? You're a fan club here. Does this work for you? I mean, was it a bit too predictable?
Kind of two-thirds of it worked for me. I enjoyed the setup. I enjoyed the trek through the woods, all the stuff with Reese Shearsmith. He's fantastic. The final third of the film where it really goes out there and it becomes very kind of Field in England, but amplified, really taken to the max. For me, it went on too long and it was too much. It, like Layla said, it was very much kind of uncut Wheatley in a way. And he just really pushed it. And it's almost like he had done Rebecca, which was a bit caramel coated. I liked it. A lot of people didn't. But, you know, it did feel a bit studio because it was for Netflix. It was for working title. And it's almost like with this, he really did want to say, right, I'm going to make a movie for myself. It's shot in 15 days in lockdown, you know, for peanuts probably, and he can just do what the hell he wants, and he really, really pushes it. Now, some people will love that, and the last sort of 20 minutes where it is all kind of psychedelic and it's sight and sound, it in some ways it's really beautiful because that's what cinema is. It's sight and sound and it's escapism. And after not being in a cinema for months and months, you know, maybe people will really like that. But for me, it just went on a bit too long and was a bit too weird and kind of lost me a little bit.
Yeah, and also I'm not sure Hayley Squires was the best cast for the Doctor. I don't know. It didn't feel like it sat easily with her. Whereas, as you say, Reese Shearsmith was just, if you love Number Nine, you're going to get a total kick out of him in this. This is like a Number Nine episode in the middle of this film for me. And some really sort of gruesome bits involving toes, which I enjoyed, where I had to look away a little bit. And, you know, and as well as if you see sort of Joel Fry in Cruella as Jasper, and he's sort of doing this nice Disney film, it's nice to see him do something completely different, because I do think he's a very sweet film presence. I really like watching him, and he's much better for me in this than he was in Cruella or in Yesterday, which I did not like at all. But yeah, I agree with you. I agree with both of you that for me, if Wheatley was trying to bait you to not like his final third, then he succeeded for me as well.
What I did love about this film, though, is most, if not all, of the films and TV shows made in lockdown during the pandemic, they're all set inside. You know, there's stuff like Host and Lockdown and Malcolm and Marie and Staged, and they're either on Zoom or inside, very claustrophobic. I love the fact that during the pandemic, he managed to get out, find a 15-day window to just get out.
Into the woods.
The whole film in the woods outside. So it is a completely different flavour. I like that. And I like the fact that it does meld genres, that he himself, he says that it's body horror becomes folk horror, becomes Doctor Who 1970s kind of thing, becomes a psychedelic thing. And that's what he's always done in Kill List and everything. He does take left turns and he blends genres, and that's what makes his work unpredictable and exciting. So I liked all that. But it was a film, like I said, for me, two-thirds of it worked, not all of it.
Yeah. But then, but as we were saying about the hitman's wife's bodyguard, which is very predictable and sort of nobody really trying it, this is quite arresting to watch something like this that really doesn't care if you like it, hasn't been made with, you know, sort of test audiences and a whole load of studio execs telling you what you should be doing. This is completely just off-piste and off he goes, and that's quite exciting to watch.
I was just thinking that, you know, I'm quite sensitive to foot trauma because I had an accident with my foot afterwards, and between this and A Quiet Place Too, it's been a rough couple of weeks to see some very unpleasant foot-based things.
Yes. Yeah, if you have a foot problem, this is not a film for you.
It's an iconic scene, instantly iconic. It's a bit like the Misery scene.
Yes.
It's like you're not going to forget it.
No, absolutely.
I think it is interesting how Ben Wheatley is kind of doing all these unpredictable things, like going from this and now it's going to be the Meg 2.
Meg 2, I mean.
Yeah. Crazy. And I was thinking, what is the weirder director announcement, that Ben Wheatley's doing the Meg 2 or that Barry Jenkins is doing the Lion King 2? These were both things in the past year that have floored me.
Yeah, it is mad. Yeah, I spoke to Ben Wheatley about that, about Meg 2, because it just seems so weird. But he's always said the same thing since he started his career, which is he wants to try everything. You know, he just wants to play.
But how did that chat come about? Okay, I can understand him going, yeah, you know, why not the Meg 2? Why wouldn't I have a go at that? Because it's something I haven't done. But who thought, let's think about some directors for the Meg 2? And who went, how about Ben Wheatley? Well, how did that conversation come up? How did that meeting even happen?
I did find out that the Meg is actually based on a book, amazingly. So maybe he's like a diehard fan of this giant shark literature source material.
Maybe. And somebody at the studio knew that and was like, oh, Ben would love to do this. And then will people complain if he does a studio picture with that, which presumably he's going to have to bend to studio with that?
I think he'll make very much a studio film. You know, I'd like to think he's going to bring in the Ben Wheatley touches and make it quite dark and horrific and really up the sort of scares. But I think he will just make like the Meg 2, like the first one. It will be a fun family blockbuster.
But people didn't like him when he did that with Rebecca.
I don't think he cares, though. I think he just does what he wants to do, and he wants to try different flavours, and he's going to do it. And then he'll go back and make another film for 10p in 5 days after, you know?
I would really like to see Reese Shearsmith take on a big shark, though. So if he could maybe bring him on as cast a supporting cast member, him helping Jason Statham, I'd show up for the Meg 2.
Yeah,
definitely.
Cool. Okay, so we've digressed, but we would say that In the Earth is something we'd recommend, but that it is a bit Marmite.
Yeah.
Okay. So that is out this Friday. Okay, it's time for alternative line reading. Are you ready? Jamie's very good at this, but I'm not. God. So this is one, and I would say with this, as Jordan said previously, play the player, not the game. So Henry, I've spent a lot of time guarding people all over the world, and I've found one thing to be true. No matter how incompetent the assassins, no matter how much they miss their target, there's always one person who always gets hit. Do you know what that film is?
I recognise that.
You've really got to say it in a laconic Californian accent.
Really?
I didn't do it like that. Think about the first film that we discussed today.
The Bodyguard.
It is The Bodyguard.
Oh, yeah. He says that to the driver, doesn't he?
He does. He says the one guy that always gets hit is the cocky black limousine driver.
I got to say, in The Hitman's Bodyguard, because they're kind of building up to who a cameo is going to be, and I had every finger crossed that it was going to be Kevin Costner.
I wanted
to. And even though it was, I was so disappointed when it wasn't.
The main reason I got that, Jane, was just because I know that you're obsessed with Kevin Costner and The Bodyguard.
I'm not obsessed with The Bodyguard.
Well, but you like
it. I am obsessed with Kevin Costner.
Yeah.
I think Kevin Costner is a wonderful star. And I say star because acting, not necessarily, but charisma and screen presence and just... whoop, Jean likes him.
Well, we've had to defend Kevin Costner recently because people were trying to come for Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, as if that's not a great film.
Come on. And, you know, Kevin Costner doesn't even attempt an accent, has a mullet, anachronistic. I mean, ridiculous. The whole film.
And I respect it.
And why would you not love that? That's what you come for, isn't it?
That's what people love about that film. It's not like that article told us something we didn't know and we were like, oh, yeah, that is a bit rubbish, actually.
Yeah. And like, and the Sheriff of Nottingham's rape things are questionable. Yes, we knew that back in the day. And that's why every TV version took out that bit where he sort of tries to rape her on the altar when they've just got married, because it was always not great.
Yeah, but it's also not like aspirational. It's not like when people kind of maybe have an issue with like Blade Runner because there's something that feels a bit rapey and they're just like, oh, and then the film thinks it's seductive. That film is very much like, look at this awful man. Look what he's trying to do.
This is the baddie. Yeah, he likes to kill people. He likes to have two or three maids in his chamber, you at 9:45. He likes to marry people against their will. And he is a horrible person. And all of those things are horrible activities. So, yeah, anyway, we digressed once again onto Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. But why not? It's a cracking film. In fact, watch that this weekend as well. If you haven't seen it for a while, it still holds up. Okay.
And that is an iconic villain from Alan Rickman, and I will not hear a word against it.
Me neither. Okay, shall we get our gelato in for this one?
Your life is so much cooler than mine.
There's a million things you think you can't do. All you need is a chance to try. Woo!
Something's fishy with you two.
This is too dangerous. Lucius!
I know your problem. You got a Bruno in your head.
A Bruno?
Say, Silencio Bruno.
Silencio Bruno.
Louder. Silencio Bruno.
Silencio Bruno.
Silencio Bruno.
Silencio Bruno.
Can you still hear him?
Nope, just you.
Good. Now hang on.
Silencio Bruno.
So this is Luca, the latest from Pixar. Layla, who's Luca?
So Luca is a young sea monster living under the sea, kind of shepherding little fish around and dreaming of going out into the great wide world. He meets a fellow sea monster called Alberto, who teaches him that if he goes to the surface, then as soon as their skin is dry, they'll kind of transform into people and can kind of live amongst them and interact with people in the little town of Porto Rosso in Italy. Obviously, Luca's family do not want him to do this. They think it's all terribly dangerous, but him and Alberto dream of kind of having a Vespa and having a wonderful summer by the sea. It's a wonderful film. I mean, the Studio Ghibli influences are very clear with this, I think. It's a much smaller stakes than a lot of Pixar films that we've seen of late. There's no giant emotional existential crisis. It's not like Soul asking us to kind of figure out the meaning of life or, you know, Onward dealing with grief. It's a much smaller contained story with lower stakes. And as a result, I just really, really enjoyed it. I think there's something about the Aardman about it as well, with the sort of kind of sweetness that it brought. It's from director Enrico Casarossa, who is from Genoa and has lived in America. He made an Oscar-winning short for Pixar, and then this is his first feature. And I think he's done a really lovely job of lovingly creating this Italian coast and this friendship, which he says is based on the relationship he had with his best friend Alberto when they were children. So yeah, just a beautiful little film.
I mean, it does make you want to be in that town, dipping your toes in the water, eating the food, listening to, you know, the nonnas in the square and looking at the bougainvillea that over the beautiful, quaint little houses. It's very good sense of place. Did you like it, Jamie?
Not as much as Layla. I've got to say, there's bits of it I love. I love the fact that it does get that sense of place, the town, the sort of sparkling sea, the cobbled streets, terracotta tiles, all of that I kind of love. But for me, the story, I really enjoyed the first half, and then where it goes once they get to the town, because the sea monsters, the two sea monsters kind of run away to the town to live with the humans. And then it just turns into almost like a sports movie in a way, that they get involved in a tournament, the Porto Rosso Cup, where it's a triathlon of swimming, cycling and eating pasta. And I kind of felt it turned circles a bit after that, but it didn't feel particularly inspired or new or original to me, that element of it, which for me made it one of the weaker Pixar films, I've got to say.
Oh, really? So where does it sit in the Pixar canon for you?
For me, and obviously Layla feels very differently, which is great, but I would say for me, it's kind of certainly in the bottom third. Having said that, obviously Pixar are always, always good. And even their weakest films, like you take a Cars or you take a The Good Dinosaur or something like that, which by their standards is weak, still compared to most animation.
I have nothing said against A Good Dinosaur.
Oh, yeah.
Come on.
Yes, I could see that. But yeah, I mean, they always hit a certain standard, and this certainly hits a certain standard. The animation's wonderful, et cetera, et cetera. But for me, I certainly wouldn't put it up with their best works, the works that, you know, I want to see again and again and really hit me in the heart and have that kind of cleverness to them.
What about you, Layla? Where does it sit for you? Is it up there with Onward? Or
Yeah, I didn't like Onward. I think it was perfectly fine, but I just thought it was kind of really emotionally manipulative, and I kind of could see where it was going the entire way, and just thought, surely this is just kind of too, like, the mechanics of pulling on heartstrings. So it was actually nice to just have something that, you know, was just chilled out a little bit and, like, let us just kind of relax and enjoy and go back to that moment of being 11 when, like, you can meet a friend that really connects you and helps you kind of with that process of growing up. Like, most coming of age stuff happens is more like a little older than this, but I actually think that that kind of 10, 11 year old time, when you look back on it, can be, like, really pivotal in your, like, evolution as a person. And it was kind of really nice to watch something with my kids and not explain to them that, like, oh no, the mummy hasn't died. Like, I promise you, they've just gone off screen, which I seem to have to do with, like, every Disney and Pixar film, because otherwise they'd be,
parent,
like,
death is a big
traumatized
thing.
Yeah. And I have to say, I really loved some of the voice acting. I think Jacob Tremblay is just so endearing as an actor, and it comes across really well in his voice. And Sacha Baron Cohen as the weird uncle that lives in the deep water was really, really funny to me. So, Jamie, we've officially fallen out now.
Sacha Baron Cohen uncle was actually one of my favourite things in the film, but he's hardly in it. You know, he has that scene where, you know, he pops up probably about a third of the way in, and then there's a wonderful end credit scene, which I won't give away, but stick around for it.
Yeah, you do need to stick around for the end credits.
And it's really, really funny, and he's such a sort of strange character, as you'd imagine Sacha Baron Cohen playing. You know, he brings all those flavors to it, but I wish he'd been in it a bit more, because he was the kind of real curveball, oddball one in it, and I wanted more of that.
I think we're saying we recommend it, but that Jamie is being a little bit of a curmudgeon about it and putting it in his, you know, saying it's not as good as other things in the Pixar wardrobe.
I still recommend it. And like Pixar, what they do, you know, they sneak in their themes. And this is about friendship and trust and self-acceptance and growing up. And, you know, there's always big themes in there, but it's done, like Layla said, in a very sort of low-key manner. It doesn't force it down your throat, so I really enjoyed that aspect of it. But for me, it's not an Incredibles or a Monsters Inc or a Toy Story, those absolute A-list Pixar films.
Okay. So you can watch that at home with your little nippers on Disney Plus from Friday the 18th. Okay, let's look at our final film, Lock and Load. It's time for this.
Did you see that thing?
Come on!
Fall back!
This is officially above my pay grade.
I don't care what those creatures are. We destroy them. Close the gateway.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm getting us all home.
So this is Monster Hunter, which is monster hunting, isn't it, Jamie?
It is indeed. It's based on the Capcom video game series, which I know nothing about.
I know, you said that with great authority, and I know for a fact that you have no clue.
The last game I played was Manic Miner in 1984. I really don't know anything about games. But just taking it as a film, putting that aside, the plot is Lieutenant Artemis, played by Mila Jovovich. She is heading up a team of soldiers, the Alpha Team, who are looking for the missing Bravo team who have just disappeared under mysterious circumstances. And while they're looking in this desert for the team, like, where have they gone? Suddenly there's a big CGI sandstorm that hits them and they find themselves transported to another world, a kind of parallel world behind our world. And this world is full of monsters. And then the rest of the movie is just monster hunting, that they come up against various kind of mighty spider kind of monsters. They come up against ones that are a bit dinosaur like. They come up against dragons, and the whole film is just lock and load, shoot monsters, and that's it. There's really nothing more to it. There's no subtext, there's no satire. If you're thinking of a Starship Troopers, Paul Verhoeven, add a bit of cleverness. It is just non-stop action, and that may sound fine. You may think, oh, okay, we're going to watch lots of CGI monsters, you know, be blown.
But it's the same action over and over again.
It's so repetitive and it's badly done. It's directed by Paul W.S. Anderson, who I do not rate at all. I'm just going to say it. I don't like any of his films, not even Event Horizon, which some people absolutely adore. I think that starts off okay and then becomes terrible. I don't rate him. And I think this film is as bad, if not worse, than most of his other films. He did all of the Resident Evil movies as well.
Oh, well, we've got Paul on the phone now.
Oh, hi, Paul. Hi. It's funny, actually.
We don't.
The Telegraph this week said about the Hitman's Wife's Bodyguard. They said it looked like it was edited with a knife and fork, which I thought was a lovely phrase. But I would actually move that over to this film because I think the editing is awful. It's that kind of fast cutting that is so fast, you can't see what the hell is going on. It's just like, you know, just loads of images that don't make sense. And it's just, it's got no flow, no fluency, no poetry. You watch great action scenes by, you know, a James Cameron or a John Woo or someone who understands action. Paul W.S. Anderson is as far from that as you can possibly get. It's just nonsense.
Nonsense for you, Layla?
Yes, I don't hate Paul W.S. Anderson quite as much. Don't mind the first Resident Evil film, but this is probably him at his laziest. Like, it just feels that they kind of had a couple of set pieces. He was like, grab my wife. Kind of do the Ron Perlman's probably free, isn't he? And even Ron Perlman feels like he said, I'll give you 2 days and one costume. Yeah, it's just rubbish, isn't it? And it was like, and I was actually like quite disheartened to see T.I. in it as well, because he's just facing the most horrific accusations imaginable. And I know that not everybody has Army of the Dead budget and can go in and like cut out terrible men and put in Tig Notaro. That would have helped with this, a bit of Tig. It just made the whole thing have like an even kind of worse taste in my mouth at the end of this, that like actually we're watching something that's like slightly ethically gross as well as like artistically devoid.
Oh, okay. Yes. So that's heavy. That's I don't know what to say to that, because you've both said exactly what I would say. I mean, it was just spin cycle, wasn't it? Why disposable characters? I honestly was just like, I literally don't care if any of these people do get eaten by these creatures. In fact, make it end. I'd like it if one of them had them for lunch. Just no backstory, no characterization, nothing. Just utterly devoid of any narrative arc. I don't know what the point was. And it literally was like something you would put on in the background as just moving stuff that might cast a light in your room, because there was no other reason to actually stare at the screen. I don't understand who this is for.
And Ron Perlman plays a character called the Admiral, which is almost like a band of pirates. They just pop up, like Leila said, for a couple of scenes, couple of moments, and I've no idea who they were. And, you know, maybe someone listening to this podcast has played the games. I'm sure they have. And maybe the Admiral is a really big, important character. I don't know. But as someone who doesn't know the game, I was just watching it thinking, who the hell is he? What's he got to do with any of this? It's like,
it really was like playing a video game, and not particularly sophisticated one, in as much as it was just different levels of the same fight. Probably playing the game is more entertaining and has more sort of nuance, perhaps, but this one doesn't.
Yeah, I felt a little bit like I was also watching one of those like really old G.I. Joe cartoons from the 90s, in that there are always bullets spraying, but nothing seems to ever be hit or impacted or taken down by this. And I was like, you know, and it's a bad thing when you end up drifting off in a film and just being just like, I'm sure the US military has got more significant firepower than this, like, and me just kind of wondering, man, like, but they take down warships, surely they can take down this weird rhino thing. No, it was just a snooze, really, and something we've seen loads of times before done better.
Finally, one thing with action films and editing is James Cameron, who's a kind of master of this, he has said about a lot of modern action films that people just don't get it. He actually said the time, I think it's 0.8 seconds or something, but a snippet of film needs to be that long to register on the human brain. The eye cannot take it in and compute it without it being that long. So great action scenes, even when they're cut fast, they have to obey this law. And he said a lot of modern people, I don't know if he named names, but people like Michael Bay and certainly Paul W.S. Anderson, they seem to just totally don't get that. And they think, right, this scene, we're just going to have like a million cuts in 1 minute, and it's going to be really frantic and fast and exciting. And it's actually just, you can't take it in. It's just illogical nonsense. I'm quite angry about this film.
You are. You sound quite angry. Do you need to have a lie down?
I do. I'm not happy.
Okay. So unfortunately, we're not recommending this one. There's a lot of other stuff out this week that is far better. Yeah?
Yes, certainly. Yes. Okay. Including The Hitman's Wife's Bodyguard is better than this. I know.
And you didn't love that one. So, this is at the bottom of the list, I'm afraid. So that is Monster Hunter. It's out in cinemas on Friday. Do let us know if you had a different experience on Twitter, because perhaps we just weren't getting it. But I suspect that it might be the reviews all round. Okay. Before we go then, we have time for a reader's question. What film set from any era do you wish you'd been on? Layla.
I would really like to be on the set of The Evil Dead 2, primarily because I friggin' love that film. But then also recently I was doing some research into Fargo, and I found out that during The Evil Dead 2, Sam Raimi was living with Bruce Campbell and the writer Scott Spiegel, plus the Coen brothers, Holly Hunter, Frances McDormand and Kathy Bates. And they really struggled, any of them, to get any work done for the couple of years that they lived together because they were partying so hard. So I would like to go and watch the amazing film being made and then go and party with that group.
Everyone back to Sam Raimi's for a good time then. Sounds good. Jamie, what about you?
I'm going to go for the ultimate kind of just out of control movie set, and I'd like to be on Apocalypse Now.
Oh my God.
For years?
Really?
Yes, I would like to be up that river in the jungle with just chaos and carnage happening and never knowing how many helicopters are going to turn up for a day's filming, because they are literally the Philippines Army helicopters that are borrowed for the day. So Coppola's trying to get them away from the war to be in his film. And I would just like to be in that maelstrom and see how someone can take all of that and corral it into the brilliant film that Apocalypse Now is. I'd probably only last a couple of days because it's so mad and I'd want my home comforts, but I'd love to just get a taste of it.
Yeah, if we're talking about sort of chaotic film sets, by that token, I'd probably like to have been on the set of The Island of Dr. Moreau, where everyone's just falling out and people were like banned and had to watch their own film being made from the top of a hill and all manner of nonsense with Marlon Brando. That probably would be quite interesting to observe.
We both said Brando films there. because on Apocalypse Now he was reading all his lines off the back of props and stuff because he couldn't remember any of his
but that's so I'm only saying that because you were talking about Chaotic. I think probably in terms of the biggie that I'd want to be on, it's got to be Citizen Kane, just to see how Wells put that film together, because a lot of it he made sort of behind the studio's back, what they didn't realize he was up to, and just to see him at work, because people so often talk about him being this absolute genius, and I want to observe that and see if I think that too, or if he managed to just make an amazing film that is always at the top of the best films of all time by fluke, whether in the moment he actually knew what he was doing. And I'm sure, you know, he's probably said since on very many interviews that he absolutely did, but I wonder if he actually did when he was making it. And so I'd like to be in the sort of backlot with him when he was putting that together.
Well, you guys could enjoy your genius. I'll be drinking with Kathy Bates.
You're having a great time in the hot tub with the Coen brothers.
Yeah, no regrets.
Perfect. It does sound good.
Definitely films like Lost Boys, for example. I know that Kiefer Sutherland and all of those guys were just literally partying constantly. They were living the role. So I imagine there was probably a lot of films made in the 80s with those kind of heady times where people just had a good time making a movie.
Yeah, to that end, I think we will leave it. Thank you. Having seen some films that were not so good and some films that were marvellous this week, you two. And we will be back next week to discuss next week's new releases. But until then, let's say goodbye. Say goodbye, you two.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Goodbye.